So I think we'll have a go green, go white. No. All right. Are we there yet? So I really appreciate, after this rousing overview of what our taxpayer dollar is supporting about trying to feed the future, I'm very excited to talk about our small part of it, which is trying to see, are we there yet? How can we measure to see the progress that we're making? And really appreciate opportunity to be working on that. So let's take the case study of stable intensification in Malawi, as I know it well. And a lot of this work, it's been seen as a Green Revolution example from Africa, where it's really focused around maize and nitrogen. And many people see this as the future. I mean, in many days, I also am very happy to see this, and I see this as example of stable intensification, yeah. But are we headed in the right direction? Is that all it takes? Like, what other aspects of stable intensification do we need to think about beyond maize and fertilizer? And so, like many places in the world, there's a political context. And in this case, subsidies have made it possible for farmers to access inputs, improve maize varieties, improve legume varieties, improve fertilizer. But is it headed in the right direction is one of the things as farming systems researchers, as agronomists, that we need to keep in mind. And we can think about many other types of indicators. We just heard about risk. I think that's something I want to come back to. There's other, you know, livestock, impacts on the environment, burning, fertilizer use metrics. So there's many aspects that we might think about, gender equity. There's a whole range of them that might be included. So I don't know how many of you were here in American Society of Agronomy in the 1980s, but we used to have so many discussions about what is sustainable agriculture. So what are the domains here? Like, what we often see these three circles. People use them in different ways. But as agronomists, we often would talk about three of them. If you have them in your head, anybody want to shout them out? Sorry? Soil, okay, I love that. Actually, no, we usually go to productivity, so that's related to soils, a productive soil, yeah. Economics and environment. Although other people see it as social, environment, and economics, assuming productivity comes under economics. So those are the three domains that are usually thought about. Let's talk about where the future is. Well, we had a number of meetings around Africa, and every time we'd have a meeting, we'd tack on a day to talk about sustainable intensification indicators, because we knew that as farming systems scientists, we really need to understand this a bit more. And with those three domains enough, productivity, economics, and environmental are the three domains, as I said, classically there. Well, after many meetings where we often came up with a slightly different variations, we finally came up with, we did agree on five domains. We added human condition, nutrition, food security, and social, gender equity, innovation capacity, you know, sort of educational one, as well. So there's still, there was a recent survey done by Phil Grabowski, who's the second author on this, showing that, and Mark Masumba and others, the other authors on the paper, showing that, in fact, there's some of these are more contested, so not everyone would agree on this, but most people would agree on these. Today I'm going to talk a little bit of a case study, as I said, Malawi, where we mostly focus on two of the scales, sort of a field, plot level, or animal herd if you're working more animals, or farm and household level one. This one is also very important, but I'm going to be zeroing in on those two scales. So this is supported by USAID, Feed the Future, Africa Rising. It's in five countries in Africa. Dr. Chico and I lead the Malawi one, and with many national partners and international ones. IATA is notable amongst that. So we have sites that we chose to be representative through a stratified random approach of different environments so that we could then extrapolate out some of the findings. And we're using this as sort of a case study. Do these indicators work for us? Do they help us understand data gaps? Are they improving our science so that it is more relevant to policymakers and to coming up with recommendations and our other goals as farming system scientists? So one aspect that I want to emphasize, we often talk about the modeling aspect, but we're also doing participatory action research, not just to improve the capacity of a few farmers, but to really use strategic systems approach where we try to test both long-term changes in things like soil carbon, where we have things that we call the central trial or mother trial, and then we have many hundreds, not just a few shown here, of baby trials. And we've also eventually starting to see some farmer adoption or innovation, their own experiments. So we're trying to do different things in this action research. Because when I first came to Malawi in 1993, I saw a lot of struggles about people saying, what's rigorous farming systems research? Some people said, only if you have a replicated at one site trial, where you look at something like crop response to fertilizer, where you could look at long-term data sets. This is the only real agronomy rigorous research. But other people were saying that actually we need to have one farmer, one replicate, or try and scope out over hundreds of sites, something that eventually came to be called baby trials. In America, it's often called daughter trials. I'm not sure why it transformed itself, but this idea that need farmers to try a subset of technologies and then give us feedback about them. That's why it's farmer participatory. Because farmers, we all know, are master integrators. They can really tell you what technology is making economic sense to them or takes more labor. And so it provides a supplement to some of the socioeconomic data that through farmers' own perceptions. So they conduct these many baby trials. And these are not just dozens. These are hundreds and up to 1,400. But we monitor intensively about 350 of them. So the types of technologies that we're looking at are all involve intensification, different amounts of fertilizer. But we also are looking at how to make that more sustainable through annuals, also through perennials, such as green manure systems. But most of all, we're finding that these kind of multi-purpose shrubs, things that give us more biomass, but also provide us food that can be either sold or be a nutritious complement. So this is a tropical legume called pigeon pea. And in fact, it also fixes a lot of nitrogen, so it can improve fertilizer response through accessing phosphorus and increasing fertilizer efficiency through building soil carbon. So in particular, because these systems, we have to always think about them, as we heard earlier, in terms of the staple in the system. And we can maximize the system for, in this case, peanuts or groundnuts shown here, or we can maximize it for maize, but we're trying to do both because, in fact, you can't think about these alone. A farmer has to fill their maize basket. They have to have enough food and income coming in. And without perfect markets, they have to produce enough maize every year. So in a small area, you basically have to make sure that a legume system, in this case a double-up legume system, gives you enough return. But is it sustainable? Is this system have any way to actually be adopted? Is it going to make a change in income? Are women going to? Is it going to have gender implications? So historically, in our past work, we would just use maize yield as a metric, and it's an important metric. But in this case, we decided to compare systems with those five domains. So this is why we're applying that sustainable intensification indicator framework. So this is, we're being guinea pigs. We're going to try this in other sites, like in Tanzania, but I thought first we'll try our own site. For one thing, we can access our data a bit easier than other people's data to try and test this out and see if it... So we had to use some simulation modeling to extrapolate over time and space some of these findings and be able to run whole farm scenarios. So we knew the sizes of farms. We knew the size, how many mouths to feed per farm. And then we would extrapolate by running crop response to different weather scenarios and seeing whether that family could still feed itself. Very simple approaches. You know, these aren't the gold standard of sustainable intensification. They're kind of what you can do with data sets you have. So, as I said, we have these mother trials that are fully replicated with yield and biomass. We use those to calibrate models. We also have survey data. So a couple hundred farmers that are being visited a couple times a year to have really understanding what is the yield gap, what is the actual yield measurements, what is soil carbon levels. So down to, this one is really messed up. So I'm going to go to the simpler one. That one... sometimes these are sometimes called radar charts or spider webs, and that one was really a crazy spider web. So let's go to the main one that I wanted to show you today, because this one shows you at a marginal site, we're comparing, I'm just picking for simplicity, three systems. Unfertilized maize, which is still widely grown. You can see the challenges with that. Fertilized maize, it's the best way on an annualized basis. We always annualize our data, because farmers can't just skip a year without eating. They have to know what their annual production is. So maize is of course a great productive system in terms of fertilized maize. But this doubled-up legume, which is a rotation, so maize comes after the doubled-up legume, so it still produces maize, but less, but it also produces legume yield, which is higher protein, and in many cases could be sold to buy maize. So if you want a high protein yield, then you need this doubled-up legume system. But if you want to maximize your maize yield, then that one obviously is best. But your fertilizer efficiency, this is one of the more interesting ones to think about. Because you're using half as much fertilizer, because you're only applying fertilizer in 1 year, and actually a quarter as much, because you get a response to the legume in the second year, so you can actually use a quarter as much fertilizer. So it's one of the ways to really stretch and get a better bang for a buck on fertilizer, which is very important also for fossil fuel, in terms of reducing greenhouse gases impacts and so on. So it gives us a nice metric for environment as well as for income. You can see that these are two different economic indicators, and it depends a bit on your fertilizer to maize price to grain price ratio, where your economics turn out. This is a really important one. We've been trying to get a handle on risk. Mostly we use coefficient of variation, or we use probability that there's no failure, because you want to make sure none of your systems fail too many times if you run different modeling scenarios. So we use that. We're moving more into trying some different probability of risk approaches, because we think that risk is a really important aspect. So what I wanted to show you here, this is sort of the heart of my talk here, is this is at a marginal site, in which case the doubled-up legume system really has a lot to offer. It sort of dominates except in that maize yield aspect. And it does produce a lot more legume yield, so higher protein yield overall. But at a higher potential site, in other words, an area with better rainfall and a little bit better soils, then we can see how maize really can dominate. This is why there's so much maize in the landscape there, right? And the economics still favor maize fertilizer. Now, maybe in the long run, you won't get a fertilizer response anymore because you're not building your soil quality. So there's trade-offs over long and short term that you can think about. But you can see that we still see it jump in nitrogen efficiency. Women still prefer the legume system, although in the marginal environment they liked it even more. So those are just a way to try and think about in multiple dimensions at once, what are the environmental benefits and economic benefits and productivity and impacts on risk and on human families' nutrition, ultimately, or at least estimate that, right? So finally, this is one of the ways that we're using this sustainable intensification indicators as both a planning tool and then also to see along the way what types of other data that we want to collect and to assess through participatory systems dynamics. So we consider, okay, so one of the prerequisites to this approach is that we've got to improve soil carbon through these producing more residue and incorporating it. But there may be livestock. Some people may own livestock that might graze that, and there's a lot of conflicts over that. We were finding the communities. We introduce a new system, produce a lot more biomass. Who captures that biomass? Is it the few goat owners, or is it the people that grew the biomass? So there's something we need to study more, understand better policies around livestock control. We were finding there's both positive and negative implications because groundnut and pigeon pea tend to be a woman's crop, but then as it becomes a cash income crop, who controls that income? So it kind of raises the soil organic matter and phosphorus issues. We need to study that a bit more, so we've started investing in that more. Again, it's not a monitoring and evaluation tool. We're not seeing whether development is improved in these communities. We are testing which technologies would have what sustainable intensification trajectories and what would be the trade-offs under what different environments. So we've identified some data gaps and seeing areas of research that we need to keep pursuing. So in conclusion, this framework, it did allow us to do a more holistic analysis of these integrated fertility management technologies with and without different types of legumes. Some data gaps were identified, and I think it was a way for us to talk to each other because we have ag economists, we have geographers, we have soil scientists, interact a lot with breeders so that we get the latest genetics. But often, when, for example, we've designed a survey together, we have found that it's been very difficult to implement in an integrated way until we started using these more, taking time to look at these radar charts together and try and understand trade-offs, trying to, for example, explain to economists why it isn't enough just to look at the income, because sometimes people think, oh, we'll just compare income from this technology to that, and that'll be simple. Well, it will depend on this price ratio between maize, grain legumes, and fertilizers, right? And that keeps varying over time and space. So we have to also look at yield. We have to look at soil phosphorus buildups. Without that, we don't understand the sustainability system. So it's a way to kind of talk to each other, and has really supported us understanding the complexity of these systems and how they change. So I hope you'll consider this. One of the ways steps forwards is that we're going to be training some different agronomists in this and other scientists, field practitioners in this approach. And we're eventually, in fact, we're not far away from developing a training manual, a basically just a test kit for the rest of us that to show us how you would do some of these in the very simple ways I've shown you. And we'll also have information about sort of the gold standard, like United Nations way you would look at gender equity, for example, where you could look that up. And then a simple way you could do farmer rankings. So we're going to try and have that in a manual that people can use in the field. And we've also been interacting some with the United Nations, who have whole people working on sustainable development goals and metrics, and they're very interested in this approach. So we're very excited about where this is going. Thank you.
Actually, stay up here. Stay there. We've got a few minutes for questions.
Okay.
Hey, Ralph. So we're a few minutes ahead of schedule. I'm going to go ahead and entertain any questions you might have for these two speakers, and then we've got discussion time built at the end. Also, those in the back, please go ahead and feel free to find seats up here. We're all friends. Make your way in. Any questions? Right here. And nice and loud so we can capture it here.
In your maize production data you produced, you showed there, you had grain legume. I'm wondering what grain legume you use, and you use different legumes.
Yes, absolutely. So we had groundnut and pigeon pea in that doubled up system. But in other ones, it, you know, in the drier environments, we're using cowpea. So it does depend on, you know, your improved variety. And what we're trying to see is how these function in this particular environment, in these soil types and environments. So then we have helped to make predictions since we're also using AbSim modeling, which has been well calibrated for this part of the world, so that we can extrapolate over time and space under different weather conditions and different soil things. So you're right, it does depend on the variety, and we are looking at kind of best fit legumes for particular environments and then extrapolating over time and space. Thanks.
Yes, sir.
So maybe there's two ways to answer your question, and I'm going to ask Sig to maybe take the second part of it. So from our perspective, I think many of you are familiar with what fertilizer costs at the port in Mombasa versus what it costs if you're up in the middle of Uganda somewhere. The transport costs in Africa are enormously high. So there are issues there that have to do with policy but also infrastructure. Then there's this issue of fertilizer markets and approaches in terms of auctions and so forth. So what we do is we have a policy program, and almost every country we're working in is working on input markets. Seed, where it's more about harmonization, seed catalogs, things to try to get more of the non-hybrid maize or non-vegetable varieties, for example, of the legumes available through seed systems, private and public. And then on the fertilizer side, very much to try to take a private sector lead. But fertilizer, for many reasons, is extremely complex in Africa. I think Malawi is sort of the poster child of maybe bad policy in some ways, but so policy plays a huge role. But then the other piece of it, I think, is not just about getting the fertilizer there at a reasonable price, it's about making it as effective as possible in terms of the utility of it. Why don't I pass it over to Sig?
Thank you for saying that. So that is a lot of what we're about, is we're trying to improve for every, you know, the bang for your buck for fertilizer. So, and this is will help farmers here in the U.S. as well. And we're finding a really interesting, exciting, over thousands of fields, relationship between active carbon. So you take something like an active carbon measure divided by total carbon, and it predicts your fertilizer response of maize. So if we don't see a good, like 50 kgs to per kg of nitrogen response, then it's not a profitable, and you can't just have governments pouring money down this drain. We have to get that fertilizer response up. Now, good agronomy is part of that, obviously, and we should keep doing extension to do that. But we also need to know, is active carbon part of it, in which case we need to see manure and legumes or whatever your favorite ways to improve active carbon. Nobody's really thought about how would we invest in making that happen.
So, and just to add one last thing, in general, Africa suffers from very weathered, low moisture holding capacity, often acid soils, so there's a lot of challenges that have been met through rather capital-intensive approaches. If you think of Brazil, for example, you know, it's hard to say exactly where the future is heading on that, but there's a lot, there are plenty of challenges.
Charles?
I just want to follow up on your question of highly acid soils. Is there lime available that is affordable by any means anywhere on the landscape?
Repeat the question.
So the question was about lime, which I agree. We need to see lime made more available. I mean, it's another major input. We do have these pH issues. But some of the improved genetics are actually able to perform better than you think under some of this more acid. But we do see a tipping point. Same with organic matter. You get, you know, there's a point where you just see a crash in most plants in terms of they can't respond because of the soils are too low pH. But don't forget, manure does also is a liming agent that most farmers use. So how can they use it more efficiently? How can we get lime more affordable? Transportation costs are a big issue. Can we get these small tractors, the two-wheel tractors, they're also transport? You know, it may be an innovative solution like a two-wheel tractor that changes the whole pH question.
Yes, sir.
Just curious about when you talked about fertilizer and maize, was the maize more of a local variety or they were hybrids, and what kind of variety were you using for the maize?
So we are using improved genetics for maize, and so these are climate-resilient maize varieties, and some are hybrids, some are not. But the main point is that the genetics are there, and those local ones, you know, sometimes store better, have taste. So most farmers have three or four types of at least in southern eastern Africa, have improved genetics for maize. They've been, you know, been getting out these climate-resilient varieties, but they require nitrogen. So the issue really for that yield gap is all about agronomy and nitrogen, from my somewhat biased viewpoint.
No argument.
Okay, we're going to save the rest then to the end. Thanks again to your first two speakers.